Just once again, man, what great day yesterday. Amazing the amount of people that came out to help, serve people that needed help, and God was glorified. Jesus was proclaimed, and I really think that Jesus' prayer in John 17 was answered in a positive way, a prayer for unity, and that was just really, really neat to see. Want to show you guys some of my childhood heroes. Hopefully you won't think less of me. Some of you might think more of me. Is Brad Meadows here? Brad would love this. Anyway, some of my childhood heroes, Andre the Giant and Hulk Hogan, Randy Macho Man Savage, Rowdy Roddy Piper, Rock and Roll Express. That's a Junkyard Dog. And then my favorite of all time was Ricky the Dragon Steamboat. All right? The 1980s was the highlight of pro wrestling to me. I mean, this is when pro wrestling really got popular in our country and was like a household thing. Some of you are sitting there going, what is wrong with him? But man, when I was a kid, this was, WWF was it. I mean, that was the thing. And you watched it on Saturday morning, and then they had a cartoon version of the WWF. And then they had figures that you could buy. And so I had figures, and my friends had figures, and one of my friends had the wrestling rink. And so we'd go over there and we'd play like we were these different wrestlers. And we didn't stop there. We would throw down couch cushions on the living room floor and we would become the wrestlers. And we would jump off the top rope and, you know, land on each other. We perfected finishing moves of our favorite wrestlers. If we had four guys there, we would be tag team partners. It'd be Rock and Roll Express versus the Road Warriors. And we were involved in this world. And we would argue about who was the best and who was going to win WrestleMania. And I mean, we so bought into pro wrestling. And then someone suggested that maybe pro wrestling wasn't quite on the up and up. That maybe some of it was staged. Now, if you believe that pro wrestling is real, please cover your ears the next few minutes. But no, I remember hearing that the first time, and I was like, no way. These guys are real athletes. They're really wrestling. They are really taking chairs to the head and getting up and being okay. They're really, you know, flying off the top ropes and doing all this type of stuff. Man, I had convinced myself that this was real. And people kept telling me, no, it's not real. The whole thing's staged. They practice it, and they have a script, and they decide who's going to win beforehand. No. And I remember when I finally realized that it was all staged. And how painful that was for me as a 10-year-old child. That these guys that I looked up to, that were my heroes, weren't quite who I thought they were. Right? They weren't quite who I thought they were. Last week we talked about this idea of certainty-seeking faith and how in certainty-seeking faith we convince ourselves of certain things. And if we think we can convince ourselves that we have enough certainty about things that we believe, then we're going to be okay with God. But it's kind of like pro wrestling, certainty-seeking faith. You have to trick yourself into being certain. Because we all know that life throws things at us and we don't understand fully who God is. We don't understand fully His plan. And there's got to be some struggle and doubt in our lives. So we talked about that last week, and this week I want to talk about what is a biblical faith then? What is a biblical faith? Well, the story I want to go to, if you've got a Bible, please open it to Genesis chapter 32. The story I want to go to talk about biblical faith is funnily enough, it's about wrestling. Before we get into that, though, we need to realize that we need to move on from an idea of our faith being made strong by suppressing doubt. Okay? We need to move to a biblical model of faith that holds almost an opposite view of doubt. Okay? And it's not that the biblical model of faith encourages us to doubt, but instead it's grounded in a willingness to be honest with ourselves and with God about whatever questions or doubts or complaints that we may have. Okay? A biblical model of faith encourages us to go to the mat with God when it's necessary. And so, Genesis chapter 32, we're going to be in verses 24 through 32, is probably, I think it's one of the most important teachings on faith in the Bible. And it's a wrestling match between Jacob and God. And the irony here of this story also is that not only is it a story about a wrestling match, it's a story that will, if you actually read it and are honest with yourselves, it causes you to wrestle a lot with the actual narrative of the story. Well, let's go through this, these verses. It says, and Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him until the breaking of day. When the man saw that he did not prevail against Jacob, he touched his hip socket, and Jacob's hip was put out of joint as he wrestled with him. Then he said, let me go, for the day has broken. But Jacob said, I will not let you go unless you bless me. And he said to him, what is your name? And he said, Jacob. Then he said, your name shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel, for you have striven with God and with men and have prevailed. And then Jacob asked him, please tell me your name. But he said, why is it that you ask my name? And there he blessed him. And so Jacob called the name of the place Peniel, saying, for I have seen God face to face, and yet my life has been delivered. And the sun rose upon him as he passed Peniel, limping because of his hip. Therefore, to this day, the people of Israel do not eat the sinew of the thigh that is in the hip socket, because he touched the socket of Jacob's hip and the sinew of that thigh. Okay, all right, here's already starting off with this story. There's some things in here that are kind of hard to come to grips with. Okay, first of all, we're told Jacob is alone. We're not sure why he's alone. Okay, he's kind of sleeping by a riverbed. We're not sure exactly why he's there. And then, for some odd reason, a man comes up and they start wrestling. We're not told why, right? But they start this wrestling match. We're clued in verses 29 and 30 that this person is actually God, okay? But isn't it strange that in here he says that the man saw that he could not prevail against Jacob? And so, since he can't win over Jacob, then he has the power to touch his hip socket and pull it out of joint. I mean, it's just, there's a lot of odd things come up in this story. I mean, how can a man that can make your hip come out of socket just with a touch not overpower Jacob? And then, well, let's stick with that for a minute. We're told this is God, and obviously, we're not going to say that God it wasn't powerful enough to actually overcome Jacob in a wrestling match, right? I mean, God can do that. I think this story, though, is told from the perspective of Jacob, okay? In that, hey, here's God comes in a human form in a way that Jacob could say, you know what, I might be able to defeat that person. And God kind of lets him wrestle with him for a while until he wants to prove a point to Jacob. This is a lot like fathers and sons wrestling. And when your children are little, dads, any dads in here ever wrestle with their young sons before? No? Okay. Okay. Well, in case you don't know what this looks like, it kind of looks like this. Let me show this.
Carry up on his shoulders! You gotta be kidding me! That's 400 plus pounds!
No, not a
four. Oh, God! No! Find the head right! Find the head right! Look at the eyes of the animal! Oh!
All right, so maybe your wrestling match with your son doesn't quite look like that. But the point is if you're a dad, if you're an uncle, a grandpa, when you're wrestling with your son or your nephew or your grandson, you know you can beat them, right? You know you can beat them. But the point isn't to show your power. Right? What's the point? The point is to build a relationship, isn't it? Through that wrestling, it's to build this close relationship, this relationship that says, hey, we can hug each other, right? We can hug each other, and that's okay. We can be close to each other, and that's okay. We can be face-to-face, and that's okay. And I think that's what God was doing with Jacob in this wrestling match. Was coming face to face with Jacob. All right, he wasn't there to show Jacob how powerful he was. He was there to show Jacob how personal he could be with him. There's more oddness to the story. Can I get back to the? For some reason, my thing's not. Can I get back to Genesis 32, 24 through 32? Those sections on there. Well, okay, here we go. All right. Yes. Okay, so as they're wrestling, they wrestle and they wrestle. And for some reason, when the sun comes up, God's like, okay, got to stop now. All right? Is it like he's a vampire or something? I don't know. It's weird. But for some reason, that signs the end of the wrestling match. Okay? But Jacob's like, no, I'm not going to let you go, right? I'm not going to let you go until you bless me, right? Very odd for some reason. I don't know why he does that. And then, of course, God answers with a really odd question, right? He says, what's your name? And then Jacob's like, well, my name's Jacob. And the blessing here that God gives him is a new name. Now you read that and you're like, what is going on? This story is crazy. You've got Jacob wrestling with God, and Jacob won't let God go until he blesses him, and God says, all right, here's your blessing. I'm going to give you a new name. Very odd story. Until we realize what it means for God to give Jacob a new name, right? And what that name actually means. Here we go. Israel, Jacob's new name that God gives him, means to wrestle with God, all right? Means to wrestle with God. That's what Jacob had done there. He had striven with the Lord, is what that said in there. Now, he didn't overcome God, right? But he overcame a fear of being close to God, all right? He wrestled with God. He was honest enough and straightforward enough to actually sit there and wrestle with God. And if we look through the Old Testament at the history of the Israelites, we're going to see that this is so true about them, that they wrestle with God. Right? Because a name to ancient cultures, and especially to Israel, meant a whole lot. Okay? It didn't just say who you were, it said who your descendants were going to be. And so when God gives Jacob this name, Israel, he who wrestles with God, he's not just saying that about Jacob, he's saying that about Jacob's descendants. And we see that as we read about the Israelites and their relationship with God, that they're more than willing to struggle with God and to wrestle with God. Now, we also know that sometimes our biggest strengths can be our biggest weaknesses. And so when you see the Israelites, not only do they struggle and wrestle with God, they're also very stubborn, right? And their struggle and wrestling sometimes turns into bad things. But make no mistake, this is a blessing, okay? You remember Jacob asked for a blessing, God blesses him. This is a blessing. To wrestle with God is a blessing. Let's look at Jacob now, all right? The name that God changed, all right? Jacob literally means heel catcher, all right? But in that name, there's this idea of a conniving spirit, all right, where somebody's trying to trick, all right? And if you remember and if you look back on Jacob's life earlier in Genesis, he came into the world by grabbing hold of his twin brother's heel, right, and pulling him. And he steals his brother's birthright. He tricks his own father, right? We know that Jacob's history is one of, well, a conniving nature, right? That's who he is. And so I really think that the story of God wrestling with Jacob is about changing a name, all right? Changing not only a name, but who he is, who the Israelites are, and who we are supposed to be. Now, I mentioned this idea of tricking, conniving, maybe just because I think the idea of certainty-seeking faith holds a lot of that. Not that people who believe that way are not sincere, but if we operate by suppressing doubt, then we have to make ourselves believe things. We have to trick our own minds into believing certain things. And so I think what God here is doing is he's not only telling Jacob, hey, I'm making you into a new person, but he's telling us, I value a faith that wrestles and is honest and is authentic over a faith that just goes through the motions and tries to convince itself that if you can be as certain as you possibly can, then you're going to be okay. God values honesty. He values us to be real and straightforward, not only with ourselves, but with Him. You look back on several of the great heroes of faith in the Old Testament. And you see guys like Job and Abraham and Moses, Jeremiah, Habakkuk. We look at these guys and we're like, yeah, Job, the patience of Job, right? And Abraham willing to take his son up to the mountain and sacrifice him without questioning God at all. And Moses leading people out of Egypt. But you actually read about these guys, they wrestled and struggled with God a lot. Job accuses God, basically, of all the wrong that was happening in his life and puts a wrong theology onto God. Abraham, you read about him, right? He struggled a lot in his early life. And you remember the story of Sodom and Gomorrah? Abraham argued against God for God's judgment of that city. Moses, he struggled not only with himself, but do you remember when he went up on the mountain and talked to God and then comes down and the Israelites have completely abandoned God, what God wanted to do? He wanted to wipe them out. And Moses argues against God and changes God's mind. Jeremiah, one of the great prophets, was convinced that God was the source of a lot of Israel's sufferings. And accused God of that in his writings in Jeremiah and Lamentations. Habakkuk, another great prophet in Israel, was a great example of an Israelite faith where he knew God was holy, But he questioned then, if you're so holy, God, then how can you allow all this bad stuff to happen to us? How can you allow evil to exist? All of these guys exhibit this Israelite faith, this wrestling with God, this authentic faith that says, hey, I'm okay with admitting that I have doubts. I'm okay with admitting that I have questions. I'm okay with admitting that I have concerns. And I'm going to address those to God. But I know we might say, you know, that's great for those Old Testament guys, but they didn't have the whole picture, right? They didn't have the fulfillment. They didn't have Jesus. And so we have Jesus, we have the Messiah. There's no reason for us to doubt or question because we can have an assuredness of faith. Well, if that's the case, let's go to the New Testament. Let's look at Jesus, right? Let's look at Jesus, because if we're going to talk about a biblical faith, shouldn't we go to the one person that had perfect faith, right? Probably so. And let's look at him, right? We know Jesus was sinless, right? We know he was without sin. He was tempted by sin, but he never sins. And so, if we're going to operate under the assumption that doubt is a sin, then Jesus could have never doubted, right? Or struggled with doubt. But let's look at this verse right here. Jesus is in the Garden of Gethsemane. He knows that he is about to be arrested and tried and crucified, whipped and beaten. He knows all of this is going to happen. And he knows all of this has to happen so that all of us in here, all of us in the world can be saved. So that we can be free from our sin. He knows all of this is about to happen. This is what he does. Again, for the second time, he went away and prayed, "My Father, if this cannot pass unless I drink it, your will be done." Jesus is praying and pleading with God that another way be made available. Are you see here what's going on? He's stressed. He's worried. He's struggling. Because he knows what he's about to go through. And he's not this idea of faith that we would love to see in Jesus. Where Jesus is just like walking up, "I'm going to take it. I'm going to be super obedient and never question what's going on." Jesus is down on his knees. He's sweating blood. He's so stressed out. And he's saying, "God, please, if there's another way, let's do that. But I do want your will to be done." But he's struggling with doubt. And he's trying to change the mind of God here. Now, I think this is a great example of perfect faith. Right? It's a great example of perfect faith because it's not about blindly following our ideas of who God is. But it's about having a real relationship with God and one that's honest enough to plead with God that an outcome happen that may not happen. But this isn't the greatest example of biblical faith, I don't think, in Jesus' life. I think this is, while Jesus is on the cross. We talk about this a lot, about the suffering that Jesus went through and the pain that he must have endured. I don't know, there's no way any of us can really imagine how badly he suffered. And he's doing that for us. He's doing that because that plan existed since the beginning of time. All right? But he's suffering still. And the big thing is that he's separated from God. Okay? This is the big thing here. Is that Jesus, who's part of the Father, the Son, and the Spirit, this triune God, this perfect community of love, is about to be separated because he's taking on all the sin of the world. And since God is holy and can't be around sin, then Jesus is going to have to separate himself from God for this. Okay? Another thing I don't think we can imagine is a part of God being separated from himself. And so he's on the cross and he says, and at the ninth hour, Jesus cried out with a loud voice saying, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani, that is, my God, why have you forsaken me? He's asking, why? Why is this happening? Why am I separated from you? If a person believes that a person's faith is strong, is as strong as they're certain and free of doubt, then they've got to accept that Jesus' faith faltered at this moment, which would imply that Jesus sinned at this moment. That's impossible. Just by Scripture, we know that Jesus was sin-free. The tradition of the church says that Jesus is sin-free. So there's got to be something else here. And I think that something else here is that a perfect faith allows struggle and doubt and question. A perfect faith, an Israelite faith, is authentic. In the same moment that Jesus reveals to us the true God, He reveals to us the true nature of faith. And it has nothing to do with how appropriately religious things appear, but everything to do with honesty and authenticity in our relationship with Him. This morning, if you want that kind of relationship and you haven't done that, if you haven't been authentic with God, if you felt like you had to put on airs, put on masks with God, and trick yourself into being certain about things, then I invite you to stop. I invite you to take on this biblical model of faith that embraces struggle and doubt and question. But as long as it's directed at a relationship with God, a true relationship with God, a real and authentic and honest relationship with God. If you need to do that this morning, please do. Of course, the invitation is always open. Anybody that has questions or is seeking anything can always come to me, to our elders, to anybody in here, and we can talk about that. But whatever your need is, please come forward as we stand and sing.
Oh, heart bowed down with sorrow, oh, eyes that long for sight, there's glad